Well, why don't you go ahead and grab your Bibles out and turn with me to the book of Exodus. The book of Exodus. It is the second book in the Bible, so you can go to the very beginning and then flip to the right a couple dozen chapters and you'll hit Exodus there today. While you're flipping there or getting your Bible app going on your phone or whatever it is that you use, I want to tell you a little story. It's a story about a Canadian university student, University of Guelph actually, who in 2008 had traveled to Cambodia to do some research. They were in Cambodia living in a typical Cambodian house on stilts, no electricity, no running water, in the middle of nowhere, on the other side of the globe. And they were there because they were aware of a radically abnormal frequency of a disease that Cambodians deal with. It's called anemia. Anemia, it's found and it's common, or it's experienced around the world, but in particular in Cambodia, it is particularly significant. And anemia is a disease often caused by iron deficiency. It results in things like tiredness and weakness, shortness of breath, can even have fainting. It can cause premature labor. It can cause hemorrhaging in the midst of labors, which is life-threatening for mom and for baby. It can cause even brain damage in babies when they are born with it. And in Cambodia, 60% of Cambodian women have anemia. 60%. And this University of Guelph student had an idea. They designed, I'll show a picture of you for you up here. They designed this little iron fish that they thought maybe, just maybe, we can find a way to battle against and push back against anemia. So the theory was, take this little iron block. Now, Cambodians are highly fishing oriented, and so this sort of gave them a little bit of like, I'll stick a fish in. Put it in your cooking pot, with whether you're boiling water or cooking whatever you're doing or that kind of thing. And then the iron from this little, it's about this big, this little iron fish would leach off and go into the food just a little bit to help raise the iron content and fight against anemia. And so they tried this out and ran some tests, and wouldn't you know that they found out of the results of their tests that those who used it, 40% of them had a decrease in their tests with anemia. And so they came back to Canada and they broadcast this news, and they were given millions of dollars worth of grant funding, and they used a bunch of NGOs and passed out thousands and thousands of these little iron rocks to Cambodian families. It's an incredible story, and it got me thinking about our Bible passage today, and in fact, actually, this whole new teaching series that we're walking into this fall in the book of Exodus. Because I think many of us find ourselves in a spot or drawn to a spot of spiritual anemia. Spiritual anemia. I mean, ask yourself, do you ever find yourself feeling like spiritually tired and weak at points? I want to be a witness for Jesus, but I just don't feel like my going out to talk to people at work or in my family or wherever it might be has nearly got the muscle and oomph behind it that I feel like it should have. Do you ever feel like I know I should read my Bible, but anytime I do, when I get to it, it just doesn't have the sign of like oomph of impact on my soul that it should. Do you ever find yourself wrestling to just stay awake in prayer, let alone having like this vibrant, I'm ready to run a marathon sort of energy to your prayer life? Do you ever come to church And we sing this music, but it's not much more than, you know, lip service or liking the tunes. And it's not this, like, this passionate, overflowing delight in Jesus sort of experience. I might love for it to be that, but do you ever find yourselves in any of these spots? Wrestling with, sure, to varying degrees, different times and seasons in life and stuff, of severity, but wrestling with a sense of spiritual anemia. I think we all do at times. And the question is there anything that can help? Now, we all recognize sticking a little iron fish in our soup is not going to help us with that. But is there anything we can do to bring rejuvenation, to bring strength, to bring health and hope and oomph into our souls? A vibrancy and passion. That's what Exodus chapter 1 starts to lead us towards. In fact, that's what I'm praying this entire series this fall in the book of Exodus is going to be leading us towards. This first chapter of Exodus is going to begin by actually painting a pretty dark, pretty bleak picture for us. A bleak, dark picture that might seem like it's the exact opposite of what I've just been saying. It's the exact opposite of rejuvenating strength and putting gusto into our souls. But wait, because we're going to see today, God knows what we need. So, beginning in verse 1 of Exodus chapter 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Issachar and Zebulun and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher, all these descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now, we don't have time to go into the whole kind of backstory leading up to this, but there was 12 brothers. One of them was Joseph. Joseph was the favorite son, and all of his other brothers were incredibly jealous of Joseph. This is Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat, if that kind of like maybe rings a little bit of bells here of who we're talking about. His brothers were jealous of Joseph. They sold him into slavery. He lands in Egypt. But God's hand was upon Joseph, protecting him. And he went from the rags to riches sort of story, where Joseph lands as from slave to second in command to the king of Egypt. A famine comes across the whole land, and it turns out that God had placed Joseph there for such a time as this, and his family reunites in Egypt. Now, that's like the last, 12 or so chapters of Genesis in 30 seconds. But that's where we are at right now. And verse 6 says, then Joseph died, and all his brothers and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. All over the land of Egypt, this family of Jacob takes over. They're getting exceedingly strong. They're having babies like crazy. And this verse here, verse 6 and 7, should actually thrust our minds back from the first chapter of Exodus back to the first chapter of the first book of the Bible. It should thrust our minds back, and we should be twigging here to a verse in Genesis chapter 1, verse 28. See, when God first made humanity, Adam and Eve, listen to what God said to them. Genesis 1, 28. God blessed them, Adam and Eve, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on earth." Do you notice some of the parallels between that verse and verse 7 in Exodus chapter 1? See, what we see in Exodus chapter 1 and here is both are talking, the command is given to Adam and Eve, and now the family in Egypt is being fruitful and multiplying. Both use that phrase. Genesis talks about subduing and having dominion, and then here in Exodus we see that they grew strong, exceedingly strong in the land. Both passages talk about filling the earth. Adam and Eve are commanded to go fill the earth. The people in Egypt are now filling the earth as they are growing and multiplying. It's almost like, is Egypt actually getting us to a sort of back to Eden kind of moment? It almost feels like hey, we're getting back. Maybe we're hitting the promised land, except we're not. Because read the next verse. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Notice here, friends, how easy. I mean, think about this. Don't you think it would have been easy for those like second and third generation Hebrews who are seeing the being fruitful and multiplying, who are seeing the exceedingly strong, who are seeing the filling the earth? Don't you think it would have been easy for those second and third generation Hebrews to start thinking, you know, maybe this Egypt place isn't that bad? Maybe the foreign land that we are in isn't actually that dark. Look at what's happening for us. Maybe this place isn't as broken as we have heard. Everything and everyone, maybe they're not actually as messed up as we've been led to believe. I know God told Abraham that he would give his people a land that wasn't Egypt. That wasn't Egypt, but maybe. I know that God is our king, but maybe. Maybe this isn't actually that bad. It's so easy to start to get little glimmers of what we would consider good and then twist what we've heard, isn't it? Start to convince ourselves that maybe what we've heard is bad isn't really that bad. Maybe the darkness isn't really that dark. And we get sucked into this. See, I think this would have been incredibly tempting for these second and third generation Hebrews, and I think it's still just as tempting for us today to do that exact same thing. To feel that exact same draw. I know God says, for example, everyone is a sinner who needs Jesus. But my neighbor, she's like the nicest person you've ever met. And I know she's an atheist, but she is such a kind human being. Does everyone really need Jesus? Or maybe we say something like, I know God says it's really important to dig into my church community, you know, to be a part of a ministry where I'm serving using my spiritual gifts, to be known and to know others in the context of small group, to regularly gather together for worship. I know God says that that's a really important priority that we all need if we're going to follow him. But life's kind of busy heading into the fall. And I'm doing all right. My faith's doing okay. I don't know maybe I don't really. Or we say, I know God says to put my guard up and to guard what I am watching and listening to, but it's just a TV show. It's just a movie. It's just some music. It's not like I'm actually, you don't need to be a prude, do you? How easy and tempting it is, as we see little glimmers of good to start to twist what the Lord says. To start to say, maybe the dark isn't actually as dark as we think. See, and God's going to show us here, Egypt actually is as dark as you think. No. Actually, Egypt is far darker than you think. And we're going to find our world and our own hearts are actually far darker than you might think. Verse 9, this new Pharaoh said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many, too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, then they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses." This Pharaoh, this king of Egypt, decides he's had enough of the families of Egypt, families of the Hebrews just multiplying under his nose, and he decides he's going to put all of them under slavery. "We'll deal shrewdly with them. We'll make their lives brutal and miserable. We will force them into service for us. We will abuse and manipulate and control them." They set taskmasters over them to crush and destroy them. They afflicted them with heavy burdens, it says, oppressing and assaulting them, so that the only pay they received was more pain. Egypt ain't looking all that good anymore, is it? And we're just starting to scratch the surface. Look at verse 13. "So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the fields. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves." The king of Egypt ramps up the pain. Ramps up the suffering, ramps up the assaults and the abuse. Twice we read here in this verse that he dealt ruthlessly with them. That's an excessive, severe, over the top, harsh. They made their lives brutal, truly, agonizingly brutal. What we are seeing here is the darkness getting darker and darker. God is showing us, hear this, the darkness is far darker than you may first realize. It is far darker than you may first realize. At first, you might have started to think, Egypt's not really that bad. I know it's not totally exactly what we thought we were going to get, but it's not that bad. We've gone from that to now slavery to now intense oppression. No, it is that dark. Well, is it that dark though? No, it's actually even worse. Verse 15. "Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Sephara and the other Puah, when you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it's a daughter, she shall live." See, now this enemy ratchets it up even more. Now the king of Egypt calls these two midwives in for like a little kind of secret conversation to hatch a plan. He tells them, "I want you to sort of be sneaky here. Whenever you go to help a Hebrew woman deliver a baby, I want you to be watching. And when no one's really noticing, right when the baby is about to come out, if it's a girl, that's fine. You can let the girl live. But if it's a boy, when no one's even noticing, just before the baby, even before anything anybody notices, I want you to take the life of every single little boy." The darkness, man, it's getting darker and darker and darker. We've now seen the darkness go from, like, they're in a foreign land, to they're captive in slavery, to brutal oppression in slavery, to a secret plan to wipe them out. Do you see how this chapter is just going darker and deeper and further down the hole? Do you see it? Have we gotten to the bottom yet? In a weird sort of way, the progression of this text, it actually reminds me of some things Jesus said. See, Jesus, on a number of occasions, he knew, better than anyone else that's ever lived in history, he knows the reality of our hearts, the human heart, right? And he took us, his disciples, as we read back into it now, into the text, he took us on a journey of saying, hey, there is darkness, and the darker is darker than you even think. See, and the darkness isn't even just out there. The darkness is in here. Let me give you a couple examples where Jesus presses in on this point. Matthew chapter 5. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you, everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. Whoever says, you fool, will be liable to the hell of fire. Jesus just said there, in that verse, he just said, to be angry at a brother or sister in God's eyes is the same as being a murderer. Jesus is like, okay, you think being a murderer is a dark thing. Okay, let's actually start to peel away the layers to see God's perspective on how deep the darkness really goes. It's not just these outward actions that are dark. It's actually even right into the inner recesses of our hearts. In just a few minutes, seconds later, Jesus says this. You've heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Adultery is dark. Okay, yeah, I can see how that's dark. But to even look at a woman or man with lust, that is in God's eyes as if you have committed adultery. Wow, the darkness is actually a lot deeper than we might at first think or accept or acknowledge. The darkness isn't just out there. The darkness creeps in and finds tentacles in here. Listen to this statement of Jesus. Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin. Hey, sin isn't just a, like, oh, I made a bad choice today. Oops. That's not that big of a deal, is it? No, actually, anybody who sins, show of hands. You don't actually have to do a show of hands because I already know the answer. Who in this room has sinned? Every single one of us. And Jesus says, anyone who sins is a slave to sin. We didn't just have a little stumble, oops, I made a tiny little white lie mistake. No, my heart, according to Jesus' diagnosis of it, is my heart on my own is in slavery to sin, is bound to sin, cannot get free from sin. The darkness is way darker than we might ever at first be willing to acknowledge. Jesus is getting at the exact same thing that we're seeing here being led towards in this first chapter of Exodus. The darkness is way darker than we first realized. Verse 17, the midwives, they actually feared God. So they're told by Pharaoh, go kill the little baby boys. But they feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. These two midwives are like, no, I'm not going to listen. We won't do it. And Pharaoh gets wind of this. Now, I picture in this moment, this is purely my conjecture, but I picture in this moment steam coming out of Pharaoh's ears and his mind just blowing and bloodshot veins across his forehead. And he's like, who do you think you? That's what I picture is happening right here. I don't know. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, why have you done this and let the male children live? I gave you a direct command. Don't you know who I am? At this moment, they take a big giant gulp. So the ladies concoct a story. The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwives even come. They're like, the Hebrew women, they just like pop out the babies before we even get there. It's not our fault. But do you think that stops the darkness? No. Because it just keeps ratcheting up. Verse 22, last verse of the chapter. Then Pharaoh commanded all of his people, every son that is born to a Hebrew, cast them into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. Now Pharaoh has gotten to the point where he's not just concocting a little secret plan with two midwives off on the side. He is putting a full-page newspaper ad for all of his nation to see. I want angry mobs going on a public genocide mission. That's what that verse just said. The darkness. We have gone in 22 verses from Egypt is not, it's not the best place, to slavery, to harsh and brutal oppression, to slavery, to secret plans to kill children, to public decrees for genocide. The darkness just keeps getting darker and darker and darker. The darkness is darker than you or I have ever thought. Now I want you to remember back to the little iron fish I told you about at the beginning. These little iron fish from a well-meaning University of Guelph student who rightly was aware of this anemia epidemic across the country of Cambodia, and who went there with what I think is a sincerely noble desire to want to help the people of Cambodia to find relief from this horribly devastating, life-threatening disease that was just laying havoc to the people of this nation. Now, you remember I told you they did a test and they found over 40% of the people during this period who had the little iron fish in their food pots, their anemia went down, and they came back and broadcast it to all the world. We figured out a way, and they got millions of dollars, and they created thousands and thousands of these little fish. Sounds like an incredible story, doesn't it? Except a couple years later, another team of scientists were like, something smells here. We need to go and retest the results. And what they discovered was, when the first team was in Cambodia, what they failed to take notice of was the time of the year they did their tests. See, they were there in the rainy season. Oh, it's just the rainy season. What's the big deal? Well, the rainy season in Cambodia brings a whole new set of minerals off of the groundwater down into that area. Minerals that for a short period of time reduce the effects of anemia. Not iron fish. The iron fish had nothing to do with it. The iron fish had no impact whatsoever. It was just a couple months of rainwater. And then when the rainwater went away and the people kept thinking, we're going to be better because we got iron fish in our food, well, they were right back to the dire straits of anemia. Here's the interesting thing about that little analogy. Like I said, it rightly diagnosed that there is a problem. Nobly desired for there to be a solution found to the problem. And they offered a solution, but it wasn't actually a solution. It didn't actually help. See, so many of us may slowly become aware, or maybe you feel like it's blatantly obvious, that my soul is struggling with spiritual anemia. I know my prayer life isn't as strong as I want it to be. I know my times in the Word aren't as deep, as vibrant, and life-giving as I want them to be. I know when I come to church, I'm just going through some of the motions externally. I know I want to be a witness for Jesus, but there's just no boldness and oomph behind it. I know what I should, and we're aware of the problem, and we even try to solve the problem. We tried to find solutions like, okay, well, here's what I should maybe do. I should figure out a way to pull up my bootstraps and try harder. Because that's why my soul is not as strong as it should be. I need to try harder. Or we do things like, well, it looks like everybody else in the room's soul is pretty strong, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pretend and put up a facade, because if I fake it until I make it, maybe that's the solution. Or maybe, just maybe, we come to the point where we're like, you know what? Maybe I just need to settle in and try to just get by with a ravaged soul. And there actually isn't any hope of really all those things. It's an unattainable goal. Just live with it. This chapter in Exodus, though, is leading us to a reality, that a lesson and an insight that there is actually help. And it starts with probably the spot that we think is the most unlikely of spots. The darkness is darker than you ever thought. That's what you and I need to start to hear if we're going to see our souls get out of a spiritual anemia. We need to see this if we are going to see vitality and rejuvenation return to our souls or descend upon our souls. We need to see that the darkness is actually darker than we ever realized. The darkness in our world is darker. The world is more broken than we ever thought. But dare we not for a moment sit in this room on an ivory tower and say, oh yeah, I get that. The world out there is so messed up, and stop. Because the darkness is not just out there, friends. The darkness in here is darker than I ever imagined. Our text here is showing us there's a solution to the spiritual anemia that we want to fight back. And it starts with seeing the darkness is darker than we ever realized. It reminds me of another story in the life of Jesus, where he's sitting down and having dinner in this super religious, elite, got it all together, polished Pharisee's home. And somehow, in some way, there's this woman that ends up inside the house too, who is a sinner. And she spends the whole meal on the floor at the feet of Jesus, weeping and sobbing and cleaning Jesus' feet with her tears and with perfume, with the little bit of money that she has, and with her own hair washing the feet of Jesus. And this religious leader is watching this whole thing go down in his house and looking at it, and he finally like can't bite his lip any longer. And he looks at Jesus and he's like, what's the deal? Don't you realize who is at your feet and what she is doing and how messed up she is and her history? And it doesn't go into it, but who knows? Maybe he rhymes off all the things that she had done wrong and all the history that's talked about around town about this particular woman. Jesus, don't you know who this sinner is? And then Jesus says this incredible statement. It's in Luke 7, verse 47. I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven. For she loved much, but he who is forgiven little loves little. The one who is forgiven much is bursting forth with love. The one who is just forgiven a teeny tiny little bit, guess what's going on in their hearts? It's dry. It's stale. It's dying. It's anemic. Why are our hearts and our souls so anemic and weak and dry and frail and struggling to find passion for our faith? Why is there so little passion when we sing? I'm not talking about personalities, introvert, extrovert, and a facade for other people. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about why is there not more passion from the bottom of our hearts to burst forth in worship? Why are we so dry when we open up our Bibles? Why do we find ourselves so fearful or even apathetic to tell other people about Christ? Why are we so hesitant to give away our money, thinking God couldn't provide if we just step out in faith? Maybe it's because, at least in part, we don't see how bad we really are. We don't see how broken we really are. We don't see how dark our hearts really are. We don't see how much we need to be forgiven. We think, the world's not, I mean, it's not perfect, but it's not that bad. The things going on within my life are, sure, they're not perfect. Nobody's perfect, but it's not that bad. I mean, I know I've messed up, but I'm not. The first step that we're seeing in our text to start to lead us on a path from anemia in our souls to strength and vitality, vibrancy and life, is the darkness is darker than you'd ever realized. Darkness is deeper than you'd ever thought. But here's the next step that we see. Just starting to glimmer through at this moment, but it's going to start to burst into full sight in the coming weeks. The darkness is deeper than you'd ever thought, but our God is more powerful than you could ever imagine. I want you to notice, not only did Jesus say to that woman, she needs to be forgiven for a lot, he said she is forgiven a lot. You notice that? He's not just saying, oh, this woman is really messed up and leaving her in that. He is saying, this woman is really broken and I have forgiven her out of that. Those who are forgiven much love much. We need to see, yes, how dark the straits of our hearts are, the depths at which we sit left to ourselves. But oh, the good news of the gospel is that we don't stay there. This is not just a wallow in our misery time. The power of God is stronger than we could ever imagine. The people of God are in a foreign land. They're in Egypt. But even in a foreign land, God is like, I will make you fruitful. I will multiply you. I will give you strength, and I will spread you out all over this land. Verse 7, the people of Israel were fruitful, increased greatly, multiplied, and grew exceedingly strong, so the land was filled with them. Even though it's Egypt, look at what God is doing. After Joseph and his whole generation die, new Pharaoh shows up on the scene, starts to oppress God's people, but look at verse 12. The more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, the more they spread abroad, and the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. Pharaoh's like, I'm going to crack down. And God's like, I'll keep growing my people. I will oppress them. God keeps strengthening them. I will put them under slavery. God keeps working because the darkness doesn't win. The darkness tries to wipe out the entire people of God. But, verse 17, the midwives feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. Even these midwives, who we never hear about again, these two women stand up against the mightiest man in all the world. We will fear God. You would think, okay, we're going to do this, but it's like hasta la vista, that's the end. But then even there, God protects the midwives. Pharaoh doesn't, he isn't even able to take their lives, even though they directly disobey him. God, verse 20, dealt with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, God gave them families. The darkness just keeps getting darker and darker and darker and darker and darker as we journey through this chapter, but not once did it win. Not once did it win. And we begin to get just a little glimmer of this. And over the next number of weeks, we're going to see this little glimmer shining in the midst of the darkness, burst into full sight like a beautiful sunrise in the morning on a clear blue sky. We're going to be taken on a journey that's going to help us walk from, however significant or severe it might be, from spiritual anemia and dryness and struggles towards spiritual life and hope and vitality. As we start by seeing how dark the darkness really is, and then we are brought to see, oh, how amazing and glorious, powerful, and gracious our God is.